Dr. C here. Before we begin, I'd like to make sure that you're aware that this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. BetterHelp is a leading provider of online therapy, and they provide video, phone, or live chat sessions with a licensed professional therapist. It's affordable, and you can connect with your therapist within 48 hours. Now, as a special offer to our Surviving Narcissism listeners, they'll offer a 10% discount for your first month of professional therapy. All you have to do is go to BetterHelp.com, that's BetterHelp.com/Surviving Narcissism Podcast. Now, I know that many of you would find online therapy to be quite life-changing, and so go to BetterHelp.com/Surviving Narcissism Podcast, and many thanks to the people at BetterHelp for sponsoring our podcast.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Surviving Narcissism Podcast. I'm Michaela, the program director, and I would like to start this episode with a quick introduction. For those of you not familiar with surviving narcissism, it is the product of many years of work done by Dr. Les Carter. Dr. Carter is a best-selling author and therapist with more than 40 years of experience, specializing in anger management and narcissistic personality disorder. This week, Dr. C's topic is An Honest Alternative to Narcissism, featuring author David Zoll.
Well, hello, Team Healthy, and boy, do we have a good program here for you today. My guest here today is David Zoll. He's the author of a new book called Low Anthropology. So, David, first, before we get into the introduction, thank you for being here with us, and I am really thrilled to have the chance to talk with you about this book, Low Anthropology.
Gosh, thank you so much. It's really fun to get to connect, especially.
Well, I've actually heard you speak in person, and I've read your book, and we have mutual friends, and so I've been looking forward to that opportunity to speak with you. Okay, we're going to need to get you to explain what the meaning of that term low anthropology is, and it's fascinating once you begin understanding that. But let's just see if we can get a little bio here. Now, you live in Charlottesville, Virginia, right?
That's right, Central Virginia, where University of Virginia is, right here.
And are you originally from that part of the country?
I'm originally from New York City, actually. So moved down here about 14 years ago.
Okay. And you're the founder of a group called Mockingbird Ministries, and you have podcasts, and I assume other kinds of efforts that you have as well with that, Mockingbird Ministries, is that right?
That's right. We publish a magazine and web stuff and conferences and yes, podcasts of our own. Though we're not on YouTube. Not like.
Well, we're going to get you there. Okay. Well, you're on it today, and then also you're on staff of a local Episcopal church there. So you're a very busy kind of person and well connected. Okay, so you wrote this book. I'm going to bring it right here so anybody who wants to see it, called Low Anthropology. And my book is all marked up on the inside. When I looked at that, I thought, now, what is that supposed to mean? Low anthropology. Mm-hmm. And as I read it and began to understand what you're talking about, I realized, man, this has so much significance for the kind of work that I do. So explain to us the title, Low Anthropology. What does that mean?
Sure. Well, most people are familiar with the word anthropology either because of the stores that sell clothes and sort of, you know, housewares.
Yeah, I don't have any of those, but yes.
That's got an IE on the end of it. Or perhaps in college or it's any university setting, you've heard about cultural anthropology, which is the study of how people sort of get along together and the systems we form and the cultures we make and sort of way that people study like small tribes in the Amazon or something.
Okay.
Like that.
And human nature and why we do the things we do and all of that.
Well, that's what the theologians and philosophers use the word anthropology in the way that you're talking about now, Les. It just simply means what you believe about human nature, your conception. What are men and women like? What are we good at? What are we not so good at? What principles govern our behavior? So everyone's got an anthropology. It's the content of the phrase, I'm only human. It's actually shorthand. It's not supposed to be a intimidating word. It's supposed to be a shorthand for your view of human nature.
Okay. Your view. And so when you say low anthropology. You actually purport in this book that we want to aim for a low sense of anthropology as opposed to high anthropology. So explain that kind of dichotomy there.
Sure. High anthropology tends to be a view of human nature that's very optimistic. It diminishes or it reduces our limitations. You and I are capable. It stresses on how much we're capable of rather than what we're incapable of. And so it sounds nice in theory, but in practice, it can be quite oppressive because you get the sense that, you know, I'm always falling short of these unrealistic expectations that I have of myself and other people. And so a high anthropology kind of ascribes to human beings more agency, more kind of energy than they actually have. And
there's sort of a, come on, you can do it. You've got it in you. You're the best, you know, that kind of thinking.
It's a little bit like that. I would call it optimism, and that self-sufficiency is always a form of high anthropology. Okay. Low anthropology views people as in need of help and help from other people and help, you know, for, as a religious person, I help from God. And so that you and I do have real limitations put on us by, you know, the fact that we need to sleep and that we need to eat and that we live in a certain place, a certain time. And that motivation is seldom 1-to-1. It's seldom clear cut. People are conflicted in all sorts of ways. And that there is, in fact, a dark side to human nature, which can manifest in ways that would be baffling to people who have a very inflated or high view of human nature. So it's a more sobering understanding of what men and women are like that understands you and I as the phrase is that, you know, everyone is fighting a great battle or in some kind of pain. The more you get to know people, the more you realize that they've got their own struggles, and it's actually births compassion and patience and tolerance and forgiveness rather than shame. I talked about you because sometimes people hear about a low anthropology. They say, are you talking about a negative view of human nature or a glass half empty, shame inducing thing? And I say, no, it's not shame inducing to say you and I cannot know it all, do it all, be it all. It's shame inducing to say we can, we just haven't pulled it off yet.
Okay. One of the things I figured out a long time ago, and I would teach this to people inside families, if I keep telling you over and over how excellent you are or how excellent you can be, ultimately, I'm kind of giving you a threat. the implication is, well, if you do something that's not all that terrific, well, I'm just going to have to then tell you how awful you are. And so the more we overemphasize how wonderful everything is supposed to be, it can cause people to rethink. It's like, well, if that's how you think, then I don't know that I want to reveal to you all the other stuff that's not going to get me a good grade. And so that when you talk about high anthropology, what I'm hearing you say is there can be such an emphasis on how terrific everything is supposed to be that you can actually go into cover-up mode. Would that be a correct assumption?
Absolutely. I think double lives and the sort of splitting that occurs is often the result of a kind of affirmation cycle that people feel like they cannot ever tell the truth about themselves. And as we know, when you can never tell the truth about something, then it that behavior tends to get worse.
Right.
But in fact, there's something in the book about how to land your child in therapy, and it was Lori Gottlieb had written this book, written an article about how many young people she met who had been told how special they were constantly, and then they got out into the real world and they were no longer being buffered from any difficulty, and they experienced failure and they experienced sort of problems, and they thought all of a sudden they were the only one, or that everyone had lied to them, and this sense of betrayal and also confusion and disorientation. There was a real psychological fallout to it.
Yeah,
that she thought was worth noting on a sort of a generational level.
So when we talk about having a low anthropology, what we're saying is, hey, look, why don't we include the sum total of everything that you are, as opposed to just the stuff that's supposed to be excellent? By the way, in your book, and I've got it marked here, I'm gonna read something, and I want to hear your comments to it. Actually, my wife and I were reading this together, and when I came across this in the just in your introduction, I had to read it out loud to her. Okay, we got a good laugh, but it's the wedding vows.
Oh yes,
you know what I'm talking about. Okay, so you talk about how a wedding is a place where we talk about the perfect ideal and how beautiful and wonderful love is going to be, and you're just going to be so enamored with each other. And you start by saying self-righteousness is, after all, the great enemy of love. And it's hard to be in a relationship where with someone who never says they're sorry. And so true intimacy requires vulnerability and forgiveness. So why not make that explicit on the big day? And then you go on and you say, here's what we might say instead. So when the couple is giving vows to each other, they would each say, neither of us is fully sane or healthy. We're committed to treating each other as broken people with enormous kindness and imagination when we can manage it. Okay. And then you have the audience who will speak words of affirmation as a group. And the audience says, we're all broken. We've all been idiots and we'll be idiots again. We're all difficult to live with. We sulk and we get angry and we blame others for our own mistakes and have strange obsessions and fail to compromise. We're here to make you feel less lonely with your feelings or failings. And you will never know all the details, but we understand. And when I read that, it's like, oh, that is so refreshing and so honest.
I know from a video by the School of Life that made such an impression on me, because you think it's this kind of cynical thing, but when people hear that, they all smile and they all breathe out and they say, gosh, well, to be loved like that in full view of, and not without pretense, and to be loved in full view of who I actually am, that's a very exciting and
and that's what you refer to as low anthropology. In other
words, that's a low anthropology wedding. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, another thing that you mentioned, the more you emphasize the hurts in your life, the more people feel known and uplifted. Now, again, that's not something that you tend to hear. It's like, well, when I get to know you, I want to know, well, where do you hurt? And what have been some of your struggles? And as we get to know each other, we share in those kind of things. And in your worldview, it's like, yeah, that's an honest and that's a very positive way of engaging. How do you see that as compared to the average Joe and Jane out there?
Well, I think people naturally want to be known for their accomplishments and for their strengths and for the facade of perfection maybe that they're erecting to show the world, but no one actually feels known like that. I mean, if this very curated picture of you is getting all this love and approval online or something, you're actually going to feel more lonely because you know that that's not the truth. And to any, I mean, I'm not saying you're going to love everyone that you find out the truth about them, but I think you won't love, the only chance for love to blossom or simply intimacy to occur is for people to find out what you leave off your resume and I rather than what you put on. And that's just true. I don't know how that you can argue with that. And the people we end up marrying, God willing, are those who have seen us, you know, on a Tuesday night in our sweatpants and are, you know, basically okay with it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I've mentioned many times that intimacy is predicated upon knowing the junk and loving each other in the midst of it. I mean, anybody can be loving and kind and helpful and friendly when everything's going great. But in your mindset, the low anthropology, you're saying, well, can we love and encourage each other when we know things aren't perfect and ideal?
I think that's the great challenge of life, and also it's a great testimony of our lives, that the relationships that we have that are truly transformative and healing are always the ones in which we are both known and loved, and you can't have one without the other, really. Or you can have knowledge without love, but you can't have love without knowledge. And so I'm in favor of the kind of dropping the pretense where you know, not in a voyeuristic or showy way, but in a sense of being like, I feel when those wedding vows are read, I feel less alone, and I feel like more able to, not only do I feel relief, I feel connection. And if we're act for connection, and I think connection is really a beautiful word for where the action happens in life, well, then a connection rides on the rails of low anthropology, not up here. It's really where you really are living, what you're thinking about.
Okay, well, let me read something else from your book, just another line that I picked out. You mentioned that self-loathing is usually born out of high anthropology. Now, help us understand what you mean by that.
Well, I think that self-loathing often comes into view when you think you're the only one, the only person on earth that has these limitations, that has this propensity for making the wrong decision. Self-loathing is usually a function. It's like imposter syndrome, or where you feel like, you are uniquely incapable of good or love. And that's where self-loathing comes in. A low anthropology says, in fact, everyone has major, you know, handicaps and challenges. And the only reason you think that other person over there is so together is you don't really know them that well.
Yeah.
I think shame.
There's a phrase I like to use, and that is everyone's normal until you get to know them.
Yeah, and then you realize what does the wedding say? We're all just a little insane, you know?
Yeah. I'd like for you to be aware of my video courses. One is entitled Ready, Set, Connect. Now, narcissists are quite capable of throwing you off balance, so this course keeps you focused on the skills and the mindset that are necessary for positive connections. And inside the course, we have various modules and inside each module are lessons, and each lesson contains a video, written documents, and then questions that go along with it. We'll discuss things like how to have good conflict resolution skills, building empathy, how to be the authentic self that you need to be. If you're interested in enrolling, you can go to our website, survivingnarcissism.tv, click the link for courses. You'll find Ready, Set, Connect there, as well as the others. I hope that you would find them to be quite helpful.
And now back to Surviving Narcissism with Dr. Carter.
Now, David, when I talk about narcissism, one of the things that we emphasize relative to the narcissistic mindset, these people have such a strong need to be in control, and they have an attitude of entitlement, but they also have this impossible ideal that they place upon other individuals, but actually it's because that's already been done to them. And as a result, narcissistic individuals are people who are so busy hiding behind their well-constructed false self that they're unable to go into the space that you're talking about. And so we're using a little bit of different terminology, but I think we're arriving at the exact same conclusion, that in order to have true intimacy, in order to be known, in order to have a genuine, authentic relationship, we need to know each other in totality, as opposed to just the, like you say, the nice parts of the resume. Why do you suppose that so many individuals are threatened by that potential?
Of fear of rejection. I think we just are afraid. We know that if connection and love occur, you know, when the junk is aired, but that's also where rejection and happens. And that is so scary, especially if you're a person who's been deeply rejected before. Of course, you want to do everything you can to not feel pain. Like, we don't want to feel pain. Of course, the truth is, by avoiding pain, I think we often end up creating more of it, or a different form of it. But I think the deep fear about going there, with risking your vulnerability or your honesty, has to do with deep fear of being cast away.
Yeah. Yeah. And so many of us are, in fact, fear-based, although we don't necessarily say it that way. As an example, when someone comes along, let's say you confront someone and they don't like what you have to say. So rather than saying, "I fear your confrontation, I find that to be threatening," what they do is they become angry and they argue, or they give you the silent treatment, or they treat you as if you're a nobody and just walk away and won't say hello to you the next time they see you in the store. And so it comes across as rejection and anger and agitation, when in fact, to your point, no, it's fear. You hit me at a place where I don't like to go. You're asking me to show my vulnerabilities, and I don't do that. And so many people in our audience can say, "I've been with that person," the individual who has such a high and lofty requirement of what I'm supposed to be, that when I finally say, "Can we just be real with one another?" It's like, no, I don't do that. And
well, they can't do it with themselves, it sounds like. So, of course, they can't do it with you, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Do you have any notion of how a person develops this high anthropology, where they have decided the only thing I'm going to allow people to know and see about me are just the good things, and I'm not going to let you see the rest? How does that happen?
Well, I think... high anthropology is flattering, and so people like to be flattered. We don't want to necessarily read bad news about ourselves. I'd rather read bad news about other people that make me feel better about myself. So I think there's I think control, which you've just hit on in the way it plays out in narcissism, I think high anthropology tends to grant you and I more control over our lives, or at least it pushes that illusion onto people. And life is so scary and uncertain that we oftentimes do anything we can for a little more control.
Yeah.
And that not just the diagnosable narcissist, but the, I do it. I mean, maybe I should be diagnosed too, but it was, the control is so, we have such a strong addiction to it. I mean, as a Christian, I sort of believe this is right there. Our desire to be God, to be in control, is often what is at the root of a lot of our.
Well, isn't that the story of Adam and Eve?
Yes, I mean it's right there at the beginning. Is what I was about.
Yeah,
to say.
I refer to that as scene one, and scene two. They're over in the bushes, blame shifting. And
it was her, it was the snake, it was
well, and that just fits right in there with the creation of the false self. It's like, I'm not going to talk to you about who I am, no way. Okay, so that leads to another couple of quotes that I picked out from your book. You mentioned that high anthropology isolates, and then you go on to say it prevents us from identifying with one another, especially at the point of our dysfunctions. So if I've got this notion that says, well, I want to be in control and I have to look right and I want to superimpose myself upon you, ultimately, you might think that, all right, that's going to get conformity and that's going to make everybody be what I want them to be, when in fact it creates the opposite. It isolates.
It isolates. You never are interacting with the real person, and the person never feels like they're really being interacted with, and so that's you're dealing at the level of the surface, and it's it creates a vicious cycle, I think. But a high anthropology does. I mean, with social media is exhibits A through Z here. It has increased our loneliness, because even when we're garnering approval and acceptance, it's not our actual selves that are getting it. So we feel more distant at the end of the day. This thing that was supposed to foster connection has done the opposite for this very reason, I think.
Oh, yeah. A very common question that I receive, and I'd like to kind of hear your thoughts on this. Let's suppose that you have someone that says, okay, David, I get it. rather than just emphasizing the perfect ideal. Let's go ahead and embrace the true self. And that's that honesty approach that we're talking about. So let's suppose that an individual says, I'm on board with you. But then they kind of look around at the people in their lives, whether it's the person they live with or extended family or that person at work and the folks in the social circle. It's like, who out there wants to join me? Mm-hmm. And they find a paucity of people that would say, yeah, I'll do it with you. But instead, they are constantly encountering individuals who it's like, no, I don't do that. What do you do if you're someone that says, well, I see it, but then you can't get other individuals to see it with you?
Well, that's the great question. I think that you, first of all, the whole idea of low anthropology is that you can't really control other people. And the attempt to do it backfires and pushes you away from them. I think a low anthropology would allow us to move forward in love, acknowledging that other people have limitations in this area, and not necessarily to jump immediately to resentment, but instead, to dream, imagine why another person might be so afraid of this. I think that though there's a huge power in sort of going first, you know, the I'm first. All right, I'll model this. And I've noticed that, and I've done years and years of small groups, in various settings of just people getting to know each other in communities, and mostly in the church. And if you are dying for there to be more transparency and honesty, unfortunately, you have to go first. And everyone might not pick up on it. Everyone might not follow your lead, but they certainly won't if you don't do it. Like it's, you'd be surprised at what does occur and over time. But I don't really know. It's not in our hands necessarily.
Yeah. I remember I was around 20 years old. I was a college student and it was summertime. And we had some close friends that lived right down the street from us. And I was in the garage at this man's house who was a very close friend of my father. So let's say he was 45-ish or so, really, really old. And we were preparing his boat to take it out for a little outing. And somehow he started talking in a philosophical kind of way about how you're very fortunate if you can have two or three people in your life that you're really close to and that you know through and through. And here I was, a really social college kid, and I'm thinking, two or three? What are you talking about? I got 20 people I could call right now. We go do all sorts of things. And I didn't catch on at the time to what he was saying. But the implication is that he was implying that over time, as you engage with others, you'll find that there are a few people, not a lot, but there are a few people who really do want to invest in you, and you can do it with them. And the connection is very real. And then you have a lot of other individuals you can be well acquainted with, but that true intimacy is not something that you necessarily are able to share with everyone. I mean, is that kind of your experience as well?
Absolutely. And I think when you find those people, and they are out there, because a lot of people have, you know, we're all experiencing life together in a certain way. But you hold on to them, you know, if you kind of go where the life is. Some of us are never blessed with someone like that. But I think there's usually one or two people that we can find. Don't take it for granted. You know, it's not common. And the older I get, the more I realize, the more, you know, dinner parties I go to where no one wants to talk about anything real. Instead of like hating those people that can't go there, you start to just instead just be, you actually increase gratitude for those who can.
Right.
And lean on them, you know, that's.
Having that sense of intimacy and that closeness where you're able to enter all the way in with the mindset that we're talking about, it requires time and commitment, and you just can't do it with every person that you encounter.
Absolutely.
You have people that are what I consider they're on your inner circle, that level one circle of close intimates. And that can never be a super, super high number of people just because of the time commitment. And then you can have people that are at a level two where you can do it some quite a bit. And then three and four and five. And then you have way on down, you have what I call familiar strangers. But you hope that you can have engagements with people that will say, well, I'd like to join with you in that. And so I'm making the assumption that even if the number is relatively small, and what I'm hearing you say is, well, let's not stop. We need to go somewhere with this.
So. Oh, absolutely. I'm fortunate. I do have a few friends that are like that, but yeah, hasn't always been the case.
Yeah. Okay. Now let me throw out another comment that you made in your book. And this one's so accurate. You say, when a person is not permitted to tell the truth about who they are, they're set up for shame. And then you go on and say, these feelings of worthlessness can hang on for a lifetime. So the implication is, if you do attempt to, you know, share who you are and say, this is me, if the other person doesn't know what to do with your honesty, then you use the word just a few minutes ago, but shame communication or insinuation start popping out. I find that to be terribly tragic.
It is very tragic. It's very common. And it's my whole hope and prayer with my children that I can sort of not be surprised by their actual humanity when it comes, so that it doesn't trigger some sort of shame pattern in their lives. Because a lot of people, especially in, you know, religious upbringings, it sounds like a low anthropology that they've been raised with. Everyone's a sinner and all this stuff. But what they've really been raised with is sort of a high anthropology. It's sort of like, yes, the sinners are out there, and you better not be one of them, or you better hide and construct some facade of righteousness, in which case there's a splitting and there's resentment, and people just run away in the opposite direction because they want to be somewhere where they can be themselves.
Yeah. That person that lives with the high anthropology says, well, let me explain to you what the agenda is. And you and I, we're going to make sure that we get everything right on the agenda.
Yes. Even when the agenda sounds like it's includes permission to be oneself, if there's a prescribed thing, you're setting up, I think, a structure for shame.
As 100%, I couldn't agree with you more, as opposed to simply saying, I'd like to know your backstory.
Yes.
And I'll share with you my backstory.
And usually when you find out people's pasts, I mean, there's, I guess, a few exceptions. Usually you find some foothold for sympathy. I've found.
And putting the same thought into a different context, people who hold on to this perfect ideal that we're supposed to maintain have a short memory. It's like,
they do.
I don't live up to the ideal, but let's forget that. I insist that you do.
Gosh, I think that's the nature of when you run into people like that who are lying to themselves, or a very selective memory, shall we say. I have sympathy for that too, but I think it's very difficult to get to know or want to spend that much time with someone like that, because it's simply you get engaged, you get drawn into this whole narrative. That's the phrase we use today. It's the narrative they have about themselves, which is simply causing them enormous pain and hiding, but it's just not true. And you sort of be like, I don't really want to be in this relationship if I'm just, all I'm here to do is prop up some sense of false sense of you. You know, I think that is the opposite of intimacy.
Well, the title for my podcast, the title for my YouTube channel is Surviving Narcissism. And there are so many individuals out there that will say, well, I mean, they won't admit it, but it's all about themselves and, you know, the high control and the entitlement, et cetera. And then you have other individuals. It's like, been there, done that, and it didn't work for me. And so I think that when you talk about this whole concept of low anthropology and saying, if we're going to get to know each other, why don't we just be honest about who we are, lumps, bumps, bruises, and all. And in doing so, that establishes a pathway towards authenticity. So frankly, David, I think your book, Low Anthropology, just nails it.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I don't want to, I'm just as limited a person as I have ever been, but it's I'm just trying to glean insights I've found elsewhere and draw on the resources of my faith in a way that I think can set people free from this all the false, you know, the the shouldas, the wouldas, the couldas of life.
The agenda. Yeah.
The agenda.
Well,
that's, yeah.
Yeah, we're all fellow sojourners, and hopefully we can each say, well, I've got my lumps and bumps. Want to hear mine? I'd like to hear yours too. And in doing so, then that helps us feel known. It's not going to happen when you have those high control people and the people that operate with the strong idealism. So I thank you so much for putting words to the concepts here. I just, for those who are watching and listening, I would strongly recommend the book Low Anthropology. It's one of the best books I read last year. It came out, what, around September, something like that?
Yeah, middle of September, actually. Yeah.
So it's still fresh and still new out there. Lots of excellent insights and wisdom in there. So David Zoll, thank you so much for being a part of the program here with me today.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Okay. Any final words of advice that you want to pass on or insight and all that we need to hold on to?
Well, what do they say? I really do think it's true that everyone you meet is, oh, this is the Anne Lamott quote I use at the beginning of the book is, I think, the key to low anthropology is that everyone is broken, fearful, clingy, and scared. Even those who have it mostly together, they're much more like you than you would care to believe. So try not to compare your insides with their outsides.
Oh,
that's a low anthropology.
Perfect. Yeah, your insides are there. That is absolutely perfect. Okay, we're going to end on that. Okay, my guest today has been David Zoll, author of Low Anthropology. And as you can tell, you know, I have been so pleased with his book, and I think you'll find it to be very beneficial to you as well. David, once again, thank you for being here with us, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you, Dr. Carter. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. We are so glad to have you on Team Healthy.